The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 6 from the Gateless Gate. The World Honored One twirls a flower. Once in ancient times, when the World Honored One was at Vulture Peak, he twirled a flower before his assembled disciples. All were silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a smile. The World Honored One said, "I have the eye treasury of right Dharma, the subtle mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, and the flawless gate of the teaching. It is not established upon words and phrases. It is a special transmission outside tradition. I now entrust this to Mahakashapa." And Wu Men's verse, "Twirling a flower, the snake shows its tail. Mahakashapa breaks into a smile, and people and devas are confounded." So this is our Rohatsu Sesshin. Every year, we and our Sangha and Zen Buddhist Sanghas throughout the world gather together sometime around the 8th of the month to commemorate the awakening of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. And his story is one of the great treasures of this Buddhist tradition, the story of a young man raised in luxury and affluence, who, as he grows a little older, as he becomes a man, he encounters sickness and old age and death. He encounters things that he can't explain. And he sees a wandering seeker. And he decides that this is what he must do. I suppose we all have moments in our life when we realize what we must do. There's always the shoulds and the have-tos and better, but there are some things that call us in a different way. And for the Buddha, this encounter with sickness and with old age and death and with the brevity of this mortal life disturbed him so deeply that he set off to look into the matter. Just as we have set off, each one of us have set off this weekend to look into the matter. We have left the comfort of our routine. Most of us have lives that are at least somewhat predictable, and we know we get up around this time, or we get up at no particular time, and we go through our day. Here, whether you're in the Zendo or on the Zoom Zendo in the temple of your own home, we have all left behind the comfort of the way things usually are, to look into this great matter of life and death, this great mystery of arising and passing away, the great mystery of pain and suffering, of these human bodies that inevitably break down. And so the Buddha set off, and for 6 years, it's said that he went to all of the great masters of his time and studied under some wondrous deep masters and gave himself fully to all kinds of austerities and practices and was invited to become a disciple to join in some lineage of some other master, but he wasn't satisfied. And that his austerities drove him to the point where he was so weak, he was almost dead, almost died, not enough energy in the body to hardly move. And it said that a milkmaid came by and saw him and had pity on him and gave him some milk or some rice and revived him. And that he realized that though he could transcend the difficulties of life for some moments, that he would always come back, that there was no escape. And so he set out on what we have come to call the middle way. So eating enough food to nourish his body. And his former seekers were appalled by him and left him because they thought he had abandoned the true way. But it said that he, at one point in his travels subsequent to this, came to sit under a tree, under a Bo tree. And that he vowed when he sat down that he would not move until he saw into the truth of life and death. And he sat for some very long time. And quite wonderfully in the story, it said that when he sat, he did not fall into a deep and peaceful meditation. He did not fall into mind states of bliss and rapture and spaciousness, as we all might wish to. But he was assailed by his doubts. He was assailed by the armies of Mara, Mara being a representation of what is incomprehensible. And that he did not fight and defeat the armies of Mara, but he saw into the true nature of all arising. Seeing into this true nature of all arising, which is no arising. And in this seeing, he at some moment saw the rising of Venus in the morning sky. And he realized that he was free. He realized that he was free, and he said, "How wonderful, how wonderful. I and all things awaken together. How wonderful, how wonderful. I and all things awaken together." And for some time after this, he did not teach. He said, how can you talk about this? Anything I say will be misunderstood, probably better just to keep my mouth shut. But some of his old friends saw him and knew that something had changed, and they asked him, please tell us, teach us. And so he began, reluctantly began his career that stretched for many decades. And the story that this koan that I read, case 6 from the Gateless Gate, this koan is one of the well-known koans of the Zen tradition, described what happened at some point during the Buddha's life. One interesting side note on this story that purportedly happened around 500 before the Common Era is that the first time there is any record of this story being written down is in 9th century China. That's a lot of generations of reporting, but this story, though it appeared 9th century China, captured something for this Zen path that we follow, captured some essence of awakening, captured some essence of penetrating in and transmitting. The story of our Zen tradition is that this transmission, as it said here, is a special transmission outside of tradition. It is not established upon words and phrases, this transmission of the Dharma. And so in this story, the world honored one, the Buddha's a great Dharma talk, his great exposition of the matter, is holding up a flower, twirling a flower. And it said that everyone was silent and only Mahakashapa smiled. We might wonder ourselves, do I get it? Have I gotten it? If I'd been there, would I have smiled? Maybe I should smile more. All kinds of strategies arise. But in some ways, so wonderful here, maybe not such a big deal. We get ourselves worked up all into a lather about a have and have not, about the stories of our own Zen path. And I think if we're honest, most of us would like to transcend all of our difficulties. And indeed, this was the Buddha's first response as he left home, as he left the comfort of the way things were and set out on his own. He did his best to transcend, to find a way out. And when he had utterly exhausted all of his strategies, all of his hopes, and perhaps all of his fears, utterly exhausted and near death, he knew for himself that there is no way out. And perhaps rather than trying to find a way out, he began to try to find a way in. And though we may wish for a different life, different circumstances, different heartbreak, maybe no heartbreak, all of us here, all of us listening to this talk, have tried everything we can think of. And yet still we find ourselves in this world, in this world of laughter and tears. And one of the extraordinary teachings of Zen is that This very world of laughter and tears is the world that we have been longing for. And that hidden in the heart of this world and manifest in every particle of this world is this the truth of the Tathagata, the truth of the Buddha, the truth of life that comes and goes with utter generosity, with no stinginess ever. And yet the Buddha sat down under the Bo tree with some great determination, I imagine. This incredibly accomplished yogi, a person of great personal powers, laid it all on the line, made a vow, I will get to the heart of it. I will dig this well so deep, this one well, I will dig to the center of everything. And we had two readings from Hakuin, the great Japanese Zen master, I believe of the 17th century. And the first one, he talks about great doubt. And for an odd set of circumstances here in the temple practice, we had read this for the past 3 or 4 days, people independently choosing this particular reading. So I thought they must know something. I better choose it too and look into this. But he talks about facing the great doubt. And I think this is so appealing because all of us on some level know this, have this, this great doubt, perhaps a doubt that I will ever be able to wake up, perhaps a doubt that I am worth anything, a doubt that it is okay to be who I am. I am so broken. I am so hopeless. I am so fill in the blank. And Hakuin talks about facing this great doubt, and our sesshin is an opportunity to face ourselves. To face ourselves both in the form of the light and in the form of the darkness. Our path of Zen is not about trying to maximize the darkness, maximize the light and minimize the darkness, but maybe maximize the darkness. Certainly, sesshin is designed to disturb you. If you're not disturbed, don't worry, it will be okay. But you may, during our time together, find yourself disturbed. Of course, many ways to be disturbed. Being bored is one way of being disturbed, being discouraged, being elated, being delighted, being joyous. We might say our Zen practice is learning, allowing ourselves to be disturbed. 10,000 joys and sorrows. But we have an opportunity to stay, to be disturbed and not run away, to be disturbed and not have to cover it over, to be disturbed and possibly not having to blame ourselves, maybe not even having to make up a story. Right now here in the Zendo, there's a gentle rain falling outside. The cars go by on the street near the temple. and we are in a hidden world here. The life goes on. The city of Worcester, the country, the world, wars, global warming, terrible, difficult situations everywhere. And we have, each one of us, sat down here, here in your home here at the temple here at your home, on the deepest level, it makes no difference. But to look into this matter, look in to the great doubt, the great disturbance, whatever it is. And he says, penetrating the great doubt is trampling the multi-tiered gate of birth and death, penetrating to the inner understanding and the basic enlightenment of all Tathagatas. So what did Buddha understand? What did he wake up to? Hakuin is pointing the path. The path to understanding is into what is incomprehensible, into the moment in whatever form it arises. Now, sometimes it does arise as a flower or the sound of the rain. Sometimes it is a great aching in the heart, almost unbearable sensation of loss or discouragement, sometimes almost unbearable sense of appreciation and the beauty of this world. But in holding up a flower, we say, and a woman who comments on these little stories says, the snake shows its tail. When you see the tail of the snake, it is clear whether you can see the rest or not. It is here. And we say this is how life is. In every moment of life, in every experience, all of the world, all of the cosmos is here in this moment, all of the understanding is present here. And this understanding that goes beyond understanding, we call this prajna paramita. And this wisdom, this wisdom beyond wisdom, is not something to be grasped and written down in your notebook of great insights to look at later, but something that is so far beyond, of another nature, from the one who observes and the one who keeps track, quite far even from the one who wants something. And so Hakuin encourages us to penetrate into this doubt, and mentions that it may be a difficult thing to do, but that it is so worth it. And so this penetrating into doubt, so important. In the next reading, we read from Hakuin the Song of Zazen. He says the opposite. He said, it's already here. He says, tell me, is anything missing now in this moment? All of this babble about transmission, about awakening, who has it, who doesn't, who smiles, who doesn't, misses the point. Nirvana the land of spaciousness, the land of appreciation is right here before your very eyes. This very body is the Buddha. This very land is the land of awakening. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. People around in the cheap seats can come up and so you can see people on Zoom sit comfortably. So we'll have, as usual, our Dharma dialogue and just a few reminders. Remember, everyone who speaks is the Buddha, and that we're speaking from our own experience. So coming forward with what has touched you in this moment, in this talk, in your practice, what questions have arisen. And so we will raise hands and I'll call on people. We'll go back and forth from the Zoom Zendo to the this Zendo, and there's a microphone that Adam will give. So we'll start on Zoom with Madhu.
Thank you for the talk, David. So my question, I always have a lot of questions, so let me just ask. So the contrast of Hakuin's teaching, you know, one where he says, you know, everything has to be, this great doubt that has to be penetrated, or, you know, is one approach, right? And the other one is everything is here, right now. So I mean, is it the same or is it different or is it, you know, so which ones are we to try?
Pass that on to my colleagues.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And it, if it was only one way, if we just said it's already here, that would be a disservice to the great effort we put into participating in the way. We all took this weekend to and set aside the ordinary things we do so that we could really look into the great matter. There's a lot of effort in that. And on the other hand, you know, if we just say work, 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 strive, 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 you'll get it if you penetrate it, that would be doing a disservice to the reality that everything speaks the voice of the Dharma. So I think we're raised when we're little children, we have a capacity to sort of see all things without comparing one to another. Right? We don't contrast a tree to a flower or working hard to playing hard. It's just stuff. But we're trained out of that by our culture. And I would say all modern culture trains people out of it. I used to say this was just a thing in Western culture, but clearly it isn't, because we just have one world culture now with variations, where we're taught that there's right and there's wrong. There's good and there's bad. There's you and there's me. There's working really hard and just accepting everything as it is. But really, none of that's true in the biggest sense. Everything is just rising and falling away in the field of awareness. So sometimes things are bad, but not in contrast to good. Sometimes awakening arises, but not in contrast to delusion. These things are constantly happening for us. So this is really also a training in learning another way of being.
Thank you.
Someone in the Zendo? Bill.
Microphone and say your names in the Zendo because you don't have
the Yeah. Hi, this is Bill with the butterflies from yesterday. Thank you, David. It was really good. And the point that really arises for me is what is this moment lacking? And I know when I take the time to look at that very question, I know, wow, nothing is really lacking at all. Only I would like it to be different or better. And when that ever happens, which is seldom, when it does seem like it's better, it actually isn't better because I get in the same frame of mind of, oh yeah, maybe there's something even better than this moment. Yeah. But yeah, thank you very much for the talk.
Yeah. Well, I think these questions to take it seriously, you know, what is lacking? And I love including the thought that it should be better or could be better or might be. As part of the fullness of the moment, right? Quite wonderful that we don't even have to really get it, whatever that is, before we get it. And then too, noticing how it doesn't change even when we get what we want, even when we get that experience, like, oh, that's great. Oh, not so good. Where was that, right? So wonderful. Yeah, is anything lacking now?
Thank you. I noticed the back of my head over here, which is disturbing.
Get mine.
Get mine.
Bill, I just add to that, you know, this what is lacking question, you may be inclined to say, well, nothing's lacking, so there. But to ask the question continually brings another sweetness to life. Like, what is missing? You know, and it opens you up. That's what I love about that little reading.
Yeah, thank you.
Craig.
Thanks for the talk, David. As you were telling the story of the Buddha's awakening, I flashed back to sitting in church pews as a Methodist kid listening to the birth of Jesus story. And I had the same kind of warm, oh, I love hearing these stories over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And the other thing I was thinking about was the twirling of the flower sermon. And, you know, I find it a lot easier to see the Dharma, to see the beauty in flowers. But what if he'd have twirled a dog turd?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't read this in a long time, but doesn't Wu Man comment on that in the commentary?
Well, Wu Man's rather disparaging in his commentary about his twirling flowers.
Yes, because he's a good one. He says, it's dog flesh. Bold-faced Gautama insolently degrades noble people to commoners. He sells dog flesh under the sign of mutton and then thinks it is quite commendable. So, you know, yes, right? That's just what you're pointing to. What if he had just swirled around some meat? Would that have been that? Would we still be telling the story? Hopefully.
Great. Thanks, Craig. Someone else in the Zendo? Willing to come forward? Yeah, Sarah.
Thank you.
Hold on, Sarah.
Oh. I'm Sarah. Thank you for the talk. This being my first sesshin, you know, I'm experiencing a lot of noticing physical sensation almost more than noticing thought. What I do notice about thought is that it's sort of running. And, you know, I thought it would be so silent here, but it's like a babbling brook. You know, it's not that I notice the thoughts themselves. I'm thinking this, I'm thinking that, but I do notice this noise, right? There's a lot of noise and it's in my head. And then what stands out, I think, more individually for me has been all the bodily sensations, like, oh, I ate. And when I ate, I could feel my body sort of having more energy, you know, or, oh, I'm tired. I lay my head down. And I guess it's just, I just wanted to comment that it's funny because when I hear the koan, I think, oh, you know, and it's just a thought, but a story. I tell myself that I need to be more intellectual right now. And I need to, you know, hear this and oh, but really it's just, for me right now. So I guess I just wanted to share that experience because it's a, it almost feels like a breaking down or something, like I'm turning a little bit into jello instead of a tree. So thank you.
I had once when we were renting a space for with another group, we were in an unfamiliar place and I was learning about the kitchen. And I said, he said, here's the compost bucket. And I said, well, do we compost everything here? And he said, well, no, the humans compost in the Zendo. this feeling of breaking down. Let me reassure you that Zen is not an intellectual matter. And one of the problems with these talks is you can begin to think you're supposed to understand them. There's something else going on here, just as you're describing, that's immediate, that's vivid, that's actually happening. And so you don't have to understand Buddhism to wake up to this moment. Right. That's all just pointing at something so much more important than these words and phrases. Yeah. Thanks. Chad, online.
Thank you for the talk. This is one of my favorite koans. I think there's simplicity, but so many layers of depth that cause my brain to just explode, right? But I think what resonates for me is, like, I'm predisposed to try to find a path out of discomfort, right? And this is like a pointer for me to practice accepting. Like, this is sort of accepting of myself and faults and life and all the things that go on. And I need that practice and reminder, like, all the time. So thank you.
You know, Chad, David said in his talk that the Buddha was so deeply disturbed that he had to take this path. And so that deep disturbance, that deep pain, suffering is what pushes you on the path. You know, so the discomfort and understanding, it's not about just accepting it, it's seeing it. That's where the treasure is. Although it's not easy to see from that perspective when we're suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is another reason why, you know, we set up Sachin in a certain way to allow you to, like Sarah was saying, to allow you to experience certain physical states that normally you would just, you know, change in a moment if you weren't instructed to sit still and not move. So you get to really taste that, what the Buddha was talking about. And when he made that vow to sit still until he really got to it, in a way, we're all replicating that vow every time we bow to our seed and bow to the community and sit down. You know, that's our, I'm not going to stop practicing until I get to the very bottom of it. Maybe never. So the real, I'm never going to stop practicing. That's the vow. And he also, you know, when he discovered the truth, when he saw the morning star, which is such a beautiful image, it only appears in Zen mythology. You don't find this story anywhere else. I love the thing. Zen uses these natural moments that we all experience, like David did with the rain. This is where it is too. It's in our body, it's in the natural world. So that moment, he awakens not to happiness and contentment and the end of all his troubles. That's a very common human desire that is really prevalent nowadays. And I'm sure back then, you know, people were dying all the time and starving, and there were monsoon, terrible stuff happening all the time, killings, bandits, you know, I guess sort of like now here. This understanding that he had, which is what freed him, is that suffering is unavoidable. And just like Michael was saying a moment ago, can you find Hakuin's lotus land, you know, the truth of awakening in that? If it really is everywhere, then it's got to be there too. And that was the Buddha's primary teaching. Dukkha, things are not the way we want them to be, is a noble truth. It's not a problem. I mean, we don't like it necessarily. When my knees are really hurting during a beautiful Dharma talk, and I'd really much rather be listening to Dharma talk than focusing on my knees. This is the reality. And when David said, you know, could this be it? Oh, could my knee pain be it? Yes. And suddenly there's freedom just to experience things as they are. It's very counterintuitive. Thank you for bringing that in.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah. Oh, it's too much. I mean, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
No.
Thank you, David. I'm always intrigued by this Buddha story, 40 days, and he was a young guy, right? You know, and so it's as if he kind of intensified this story, this experience of pain and suffering, and then just said, "I'll get to the bottom of it." Well, I'm a slow learner. You know, so decades and decades of, I guess, avoiding all that. I really love the thread that's been coming through this dialogue about the body. And because what's brought me a little closer is the pain and the loss, especially the loss and the exhaustion, right? That job gone, that relationship gone. And then they just start mounting up over the decades, right? Mm-hmm. And at some point you just start to let go, and it's, you know, it's not a decision even, but it's a way to smile, and it's a way to see the flower. And gosh, why does it take so long? So, but it is the exhaustion, it is the pain, it is, because that's what forces the thinking to kind of just let go somehow,
right? And so all these things we look in our life, we say, well, this was a good thing that happened, then this was a bad thing that happened. And it's, well, yes, it is good and bad. And these great disturbances of sickness, old age, and death, it's like, well, who programmed the universe? This is crazy. But as you say, for all of us here, there is one moment or many moments where we realize we've turned and we haven't made a decision. It's not like, okay, on the first day of December, I'm gonna really turn toward it. But we kind of run out of options.
Right.
We get so tired, or we've tried it all, and we find that we've already turned in this way. And then this path, it's like, oh, this makes sense. And one of the important teachings is that everything has been required for you to be here. Mm-hmm. Every single thing. Thank you, Jesus, we say. Not one thing, not one step leads astray, going and coming. So how beautiful that it's you've been led here, me. All of us. Yeah. Pierce.
Thank you, David. You know, I noticed that when I heard these two readings by Hakuin, I was a little upset because they're contradictory, as you say. And I guess that I felt like here you are throwing at us the great paradox of Zen. And at the end of your talk, you said, yeah, they contradict each other. And then you stopped. you didn't continue. And I find this reading, Great Doubt, to be terrifying in some sense. And I can't reconcile it with the refuge that the other reading offers, except to say that, you know, my conception of practice is just a conception, and it's really a mystery, whether it is just letting go or whether it is knocking my head against the wall. It doesn't do to think of it in either way. But I still have a question about great doubt. I think of Hakuin's reading as presenting his experience. And I think that you're suggesting that look for your own great doubt. What is it? Why are you so terrified of this particular reading? What is it that that scares you about it? So that was my question. And maybe I'm trying to get you to shed some light on it inadvertently or surreptitiously. Anyway, thank you, David.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Pierce, so this is the thread, as Chris said, that we're looking into, right? This is the paradox, and that really there's no paradox. And that's important to see that the paradox is thinking. It's setting up one thing against another, you know, setting up like and dislike, the disease of the mind, as we say in another text. So here we have your question bubbling up through all of the mind waves of the paradox. Feels like it cuts right through the terror that arises when you confront that text. Is all you have to do. I don't mean to diminish it. The practice itself is to turn towards it as much as you can bear, to turn towards that terror. And then when you can't anymore, you know, do something nice for yourself and then come back. This is why we sit and walk. We don't just keep sitting all the time. We move towards, we move away from constantly this little swinging motion of intensity and relief. And so that's your job. This is your koan, right? This is like Bill's koan that he mentioned in the very first comment. You know, these lines pull at us, and so then we look at what is pulling. And there is one thing. There's one thing that I see in both texts that is perfectly. In sympathy with each other, they're resonating together, and I've had these experiences being on the ice flow, you know, just nothing in front of you, nothing behind you. With Todd, who's not here, gave a wonderful talk the other night about just that very thing, an experience he'd had being on the ice, not knowing where he was, that feeling of what is this, and Hakuin refers to it also in the Song of Zazen, this endless wandering through the six worlds. You know, the six worlds are the worlds of suffering and delusion, right? The realm of the gods and the human realm and the hell realms were constantly lost. So that's where there's some commonality here. And where do you go with that? I'm not going to answer the question, but I think Michael is going to answer. Excited to hear
this. You know, Pierce, I love the idea of the Zen paradox, and you hear all these teachings that seem like a paradox, and really they're only a paradox when you conceptualize them. A life lived directly is not a paradox; it's life. You know, I heard the talk. From Todd, it was a wonderful talk, and he talked about being in the middle of a plane of ice at nighttime. I mean, right there, he saw the open sky, beautiful sun, and then the fear of what if he fell through the ice, and then the beauty of the spacious. You know, that's a paradox only when you consider it in concept. When you're living it, you're just there on the ice, open.
Yeah, thanks, Pierce. So Lara and then Zeb.
So I was drawn in by the smile part. I've been kind of tangled up lately in something a friend said to me, and something I've known about myself, like that I have a disposition to smile more. But she recently said, you know, you cannot smile too. And so I really contemplated that yesterday. And it really kind of made me a little more confused. But it was a fun tangle to be in. And I was telling my partner about it. And I said, you know, like maybe I shouldn't smile as much. And he said to me, well, when you're smiling, do you want to be frowning? And it just really hit me like, oh, you know, I don't need to think about this so much. And maybe even in this story, it was just such a beautiful pointer right back to it. Like there wasn't, you know, perhaps it was just what happened, you know, and perhaps it's just what happens for me. So there was some just kind of like untangling, and I'm sure I'll get retangled up in it again soon, but it was a sweet pointer to something that's been emerging anyway.
Well, when people point things out to us, rarely do I feel good about what people point out. Right? So your smile, what's the problem with Laura? Well, she smiled. What can we do about that? But of course, whatever we do, it contains the whole world. And so on the one hand, we can only be who we are. I once went through a period where someone told me I was a nice guy. And I thought, oh, that's terrible. So I really tried to be not a nice guy. And it was just so exhausting. I had to give up. So I said, okay, I'm going to be a nice guy. But also see how I could use being a nice guy as an avoidance strategy, you know, very effective way. So how to see into it and full permission to be who we can't help. I don't think there's much hope for you, Lonnie. but as we embody, fully embody, then it's the smile that lights the whole universe. Yeah. So. Maybe last one with Zeph.
I do anything.
It doesn't make you louder, so you have to be just as loud as normal.
Got it.
But you want to.
But they hear.
They hear you. It's on. The people in the other side don't hear you.
So I'm like exhausted, not for any special reason, just poor sleep a bunch of days previously. So I've been like dying my way through sashimi, like, you know, sitting and like falling over. Like David, your talk, I heard the beginning, I heard
the middle somewhere. Is this good?
Yeah.
And I will say, from my impression, it's definitely got the record for the longest Dharma talk of all time. 2 or 3 hours at least. Anyway, my great doubt is whether I can make it to lunchtime. But now I feel, oh, for sure. But, you know, the doubt will change again. Okay. Anyway, that's my...
You know, one of the things I'm interested in, because I didn't think it was that long. I was actually surprised at how short it was. So, but that, there you go again, right, Mom?
Sure, everybody's a critic.
But I was really struggling physically through it, not with fatigue, which I often do, but with pain instead. And I wonder if you have an experience similar to mine. I'm just curious. It changed once I just let it kind of do its thing. You know, so I became very interested in the experience of pain. And I noticed it just wasn't the same moment to moment. And then when he said, thank you, I had a feeling that I would just feel this great relief. It was just another series of experiences that started. And I was really amazed that it wasn't a relief. There was just now this. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you've been able to look into the fatigue in that way, really investigate it. If you have, let us know. If you haven't, it's a recommendation.
I was annoyed, yes.
Yes.
To realize the fatigue kind of like painful, mm-hmm. where it's like hard to kind of think straight. So there was definitely like, sometimes there's like a ferocity of like, oh, I'm going to get to the next moment. And sometimes there's just like lost time. And then,
yep.
And then sometimes the talk's done. And I was like, wow, that's so fast.
I imagine all of us also have the experience of the bell ringing, Will releasing us from some hell realm. and it's just like, what happened? You know, I'm not falling asleep now. What's going on? I'm not in pain now. What's like now this? And it's really very similar to what Michael was saying, that if we don't conceptualize the little, then we get to really experience moment after moment, you know, like Todd Yonkman's talk with the scary ice and the beautiful sky and the scary ice and the beautiful sky. And it wasn't just one thing. So the little black box we call tiredness, pain, anger, sadness, it's just full of phenomenon. And that's part of the promise of being awake.
It's a Pandora's box, right?
Not exactly, but it's a box.
Well, you let it out, and then it does all kinds of crazy things.
Evil things. It's the wondrous nature of reality manifesting itself. Yeah, thank you.
So let's restore the Zendo and come back to our Zazen.